Tax Resolution Ninja Show, where we feature the top experts on all things tax to help you understand, navigate, and resolve all your tax-related issues. Now, let's get started with the show.
Hi, I'm Alan Rolnick. I'm the host of the Tax Resolution Ninja Show, where I feature top leaders who help people with important life issues, such as employment, educational activities, immigration, settling, underinsurance funding, divorce, health issues, losing a job, sales and marketing issues, and much, much more. Some of my past guests are Jeffrey Schneider, who's an expert in tax resolution, Eric Cohen, who runs his own insurance company, Adrian Miller is a terrific sales and marketing person, Sylvia Heyman, who talks about her growing up as an immigrant from the Holocaust, and Evan Rabin, who is running a virtual chess camp right now for children, and I think he's even doing it for adults.
Sounds pretty cool. A lot of people pivoting these days.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing lots of things. Our sponsor today is Tri-State Tax Resolution. Received a letter from the IRS and the New York State Department of Taxation? Don't panic. Call the emergency room of Tri-State Tax Resolution at 718-841-7317. If you know that you have unfiled tax returns and or you owe back taxes, call Tri-State Tax Resolution's emergency room. Again, at 718-841-7317 and ask to speak to me, Alan Rolnick. I personally will see to it that your tax problem will be permanently resolved. The benefit to you is that there will be no more sleepless nights, no levy on your wages, your employer will not know, and the possibility of no liens on your assets. It will keep your children, dog, and mother-in-law in the process. Our emergency room is now open to help you. Call immediately, 718-841-7317, and we will send you a free copy of our book, Solve Your Tax Problem Now, when you schedule an appointment. I have with me today Nancy Schick, a New York City attorney. Nancy helps people and businesses with employment issues, ethno-religious mediation issues, conflict resolution. She's a conflict resolution coach, a diversity trainer, and an author. And I believe that she's also taught many courses on online because of COVID. I don't know if you were doing that before.
I was actually doing it before because a lot of my clients are small businesses with remote workforces. So I was already set up for it. But yes, the pandemic definitely increased my online work. All of my in-person trainings moved online. And that includes my diversity, the sexual harassment, all of it. Everything went online as of March 11th.
Thank you. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule for letting me interview you and joining my podcast.
You're welcome. And you know, I've said before, you and I could chat all day.
Then we wouldn't get any work done.
That's true. So we won't, although we could.
I think our clients would not be too happy if we did that.
No, I don't think so.
So I have a question that I didn't have before until I read your blurb on LinkedIn. What ethno-religious mediator? What does that entail?
So I work with ethno-religious conflict. So it's pretty much anything in the isms. So it's racism, sexism, religious discrimination. That's a very specific training that I got through the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation. Right? And then I spent 2 years as their main representative to the United Nations.
Wow. Now you're a representative. What area in the United Nations were you part of?
So the way that works is when you're with an NGO, a non-governmental organization, you have a special consultative status where we go and participate in various events such as the General Assembly. Let's see, I did some of them on age discrimination and ageism. And then of course the women's projects, because, well, I'm a woman. I tend to know a little about women's issues. And so I would go and participate in some of the discussions, learn from the other countries about what they were dealing with regarding those particular issues. And then because of our mediation programs, I would look for opportunities to offer mediation in some of those disputes, or just teach people how to use mediation when they go back to their home countries in different disputes. You know, the idea is to offer something other than armed resolution.
Okay, so what was that? I don't know. Say somebody from, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a country that's where women are not treated well, like Saudi Arabia. Was there a representative from Saudi Arabia on this committee, or?
They were always invited. You know, that's one of the things when you have 190 countries coming to an event, you know, everybody has their seat for their delegates. So that's the way the UN usually works, is you'll see down toward the front, you know, just like you see it on TV, and everybody has their, like the United States has its section and it has its sign. Sometimes the United States wasn't even at some of these. So, and in everyone's defense, is there are a lot of different issues that these organizations and countries and the representatives are dealing with that they don't always have time to go to every single meeting. Would we see different representatives from the various countries? And, you know, South America, for example, has various countries that have issues with women's rights and women being raped, et cetera, right? And we still had delegates there. We had other delegates from other non-governmental organizations that were actually on the ground with the survivors of like gang rape by the military. And so it was really talk about diverse group. It was a diverse group. You saw every level, indigenous peoples. I went to some of them on it with some of the indigenous peoples in various countries. And the stories that you hear are heartbreaking, to be perfectly honest. However, they're also very inspiring, because the women that are coming usually, or the men, there are definitely men involved also. We had representatives from Turkey right after the reporters were being murdered, right, and held by the government. So we had a lot of different stories, and they can also be quite inspiring, because if they're coming to the United Nations, they've survived, and they have ideas on what we can do to bring more sustainable peace. Because that's one of the biggest challenges as a peacemaker myself, and even in the mediation context, you can resolve a dispute. This is also why I moved away from litigation, right? You can always resolve disputes temporarily, but for sustainable peace, no matter what the conflict is, you need to have an infrastructure for the ongoing relationship, because we have this thing in the courts that kind of says you get a judgment or a settlement and now it's over and somehow everything's supposed to be okay. But, you know, you see it in family law in particular. They divorce, they have a custody order and a visitation order, and that doesn't solve everything, right? You still have ongoing relationships with people. So being able to train individuals on how to interact with people that have different personality styles is one of the big things that I work with people on, and looking at different worldviews. That was the big thing that I got out of working with ICERM, was being able to listen to somebody with a completely different worldview, meaning they saw the world differently than I do, still being able to listen to them when I disagree with them and hear something that we have in common, so that we can start building bonds and work together. And that's kind of my mission in the world now.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that some of these people, when they go back to their own countries, I mean, are they putting their own lives back in danger?
Sometimes, yes.
That's got to be rough, because, you know, they go back with these ideas that'll help you know, resolve whatever situation they're in back home, and, you know, the government finds out and says, "Hey, on me." Yes.
Yeah, and it's the painful reality. And I saw that even in law school. I took an employment law class where we worked with schools in Mexico and Canada. I was in Buffalo. And we had people that would come up that had tried to organize unions, for example, in Mexico, that were here on asylum visas because of the death threats.
Right.
By arguably I don't want to say who was involved, because obviously there are allegations and we never really know the full story. And as a lawyer, I do still look for, I want as much evidence as I can before I draw any conclusions. But the representation was that they were here on asylum because there were threats on their lives because they were trying to organize.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's got to be rough.
Yeah.
That's got to be a rough situation.
Yeah. And that reminds me frequently on the days when I'm whining because I have to wear a mask to go outside. You know, even with New York sometimes being a little violent, I have been violently assaulted here in New York, and that shifted a lot of my thinking. And the way that I practice law and what I'm doing with my life, but I'm still not in as bad a situation as most people in some of these countries, you know.
No, as bad as it may feel like it gets here at times, we're still better off than most places.
Yeah, yeah. And yet there are bright spots in other places too. That was another thing that I really got from being at the UN is meeting people that still found ways to create joy and peace in their lives under extraordinary circumstances. And that, like I said, that inspired me to keep working to overcome whatever I can and work with other people to lift them up. You know, it's always like, first get your own house in order and then start, you know, inviting other people over. And well, don't do that literally right now because we do still have a pandemic. But it's, you know, it's really looking at that as like, how do we continuously help each other in with whatever we have available? And I think that's another thing, you know, looking at the careers we've chosen and how we run our lives is like, there's so much that needs to be done in the whole world. But you may not be the person to do all of it.
Right.
So you just find what you've been uniquely gifted to do, whether it be by some sort of divine intervention or what the paths that you chose for education and the experience that you got, and you use what you have. You don't have to necessarily go become a new person and go on a mission or become a pastor or whatever you might think you have to do, right? Like, you don't have to be ordained to help. You just help with whatever you have available to you. Absolutely. And that was another thing that I saw from the people I met who had recovered from some extraordinary circumstances.
That's amazing. It's just, you know.
So that was a different conversation than I thought we were going to have. But thank you for asking about that, because I really enjoyed my time at the UN and learned a lot and still bring it forward in my day-to-day life.
It's amazing how the conversation turns to something totally different than what we had planned on. But
yeah.
Anyway, employment issues. Do you help both the employee and the business owner?
Well, I do. That's part of what it is to be a mediator, is I do not litigate in those areas anymore. What I primarily focus on is either mediating, where we bring the parties together. So it's an employee, usually, and an employer, manager, you know, representative of the employer, and facilitate conversation toward resolution without litigation, right? So my goal, as you know from seeing my videos, my goal is to keep people out of court. So that's what mediation is all about. I sometimes serve as like their ombudsperson if they're so small that they don't have HR. And so I can serve in that role where I'm helping them in that way. And then I'm very proactive in the training. Is my training is not just a check the box training where, yeah, it's going to have the law and it's going to have all the requirements that you need to get your, you know, your to check your box, to get your certification. But it's also about teaching them to think a little bit differently about how to apply law, because it's not solely for the purpose of checking that box and avoiding court. There's an opportunity here to build relationships. So you have, again, sustainable peace in the workplace, right? And then those same tools you can take and use them at home. And then you have sustainable peace at home. Wow. Right? You start to have better friendships. You start to have a better relationship with yourself and the way you see the world. And again, some of this probably does come from being deeply inspired by the people that I met at the UN.
So an employer, I don't know, he's had somebody working for them for him or her for 10, 15 years.
Uh-huh.
And the relationship was never great, but they managed to get along. Somehow, as the years have gone by, it's deteriorating.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where the employer wants to fire the employee, but is afraid to.
That's a very common conflict that I deal with.
Well, I mean, how do you resolve a situation like that?
So the classic way that I deal with it is the first thing I do is from the very first call is I listen for what it is that's really wanted. Right. There's a different way of listening for, oh, you said you want litigation. Great. Push you into litigation. Right. You know, this is just as well as I do that sometimes clients come to you and think they want a certain thing because they've done their internet research and they think they know. Right. And they don't recognize the full range of options. Right. So that the situation you described, I deal with commonly. And I can think of one in particular where that was the situation. It was somebody that they had worked together. They had been friends and the relationship had deteriorated, but they still cared a lot about each other. And one of the reasons the employer had not fired the employee, even though he was underperforming and causing the owner a lot of problems, you know, the owner kept thinking about, well, what about his family? What, you know, he's still got a young child that's in school. And so what we did is, you know, I heard that the concern of like, I want to do the right thing, even though they call a lawyer because they think they don't want to get sued. Right. But what they're really doing is saying, I want to do the right thing, but I don't know what it is. And I need to do the right thing for the business because it's costing me money to have an underperforming employee. But I also want to do what's right for the employee. And so you can, when you start to hear that, it becomes a lot less about the termination and a lot more about the relationship. So I said, well, since it sounds like you still care about this person and you have business metrics that you have to meet so that you can keep your business open, let's look at the metrics you set for this particular employee. And you know as well as I do, especially with a small business, they go, what? What metrics? What are you talking about? I'm like, well, did you give them a job description? Do they know what the expectations of the job are? And it was, you know, it's something that sounds so corporate for some small business owners. And they think, well, no, I'm not big enough that I need that. They just do what I need them to do. And to some degree, that's true. But it all comes back then to conversation, which is why, again, as a mediator, I'm always facilitating conversations. And ultimately, that's what we did, is we laid out a new job description, some measurable results. We talked to the employee about the income that was needed for the business, what kind of revenue needed to be generated, and how that employee's role played into the overarching goal that kept the business healthy, and if the business wasn't healthy, how that was also going to affect him. So it was a different conversation than either do this or get fired. right? It was like, hey, we're on the same team here. You're the third baseman. I'm the first baseman. I need you to throw me the ball when you get it, right? So I can get the out. If you don't explain that to them, and having taught, I've coached softball too. I taught my boyfriend recently how to play in the past couple of years, and it was, and I had forgotten, like, not everybody instinctively knows if you get the ball and you're playing at third base where to throw it. They're like, oh, I got the ball. But if they don't know what to do with it next, they're not going to be successful. And so that's what we started doing, is working on different plans that way. And it's changed the way he operates his entire business now. It's slow going, but in the long term, the results will be there, where he will have dedicated employees who help each other, because now they understand the full picture. They can train new employees, or they can work more as a team where everybody's working toward the common goal. And we just forget that as employers.
So how do you get, I mean, a small employer, you know, he's a sole person running the business. How do you get them to buy into the fact that he's got to do these job descriptions all of a sudden, and lay everything out, because he's going to say, what are you talking about? I'm a small guy. What do I need this for?
And you're right, because it sounds like, oh, that sounds just so corporate and organized, right. And way more than I need. Yeah. And I work with a lot of creative professionals, and they think that, you know, that, oh, being free means, you know, willy-nilly, I'll just pick up whenever I want and do whatever I want. And that works to a certain degree, and it works for some people. I even will do now personality assessments to help them figure out how their brain works. It by default, and then we structure it around their default brain patterning. But usually what I find is with the classic small business owner is I go to the pain point of, are you overwhelmed? Do you need more help? Do you know how you're going to get more help? You're going to get other people trained to do what you do. And the more you can delegate, the better off it is going to be for you, because you're not going to have to do everything. So when they start seeing that, oh, wow, now because I have something that somebody, a document somebody can refer to when I'm not around, which means I don't have to monitor everyone, and things just happen automatically, it's heaven, right? And so that's usually the buy-in. It takes a little bit of time, and not everybody buys in.
Yeah.
And that's okay. My clients tend to buy in because they know that there's something more to this. They've already tried everything, right? So by the time they come to me, they're kind of in a pickle. They're a little more open to trying something new. And that's relatively simple compared to making a bad hire and spending 2 years paying off the debt from that bad hire.
Right. All right, same situation, and the employer is sort of not in compliance with, like, OSHA and the environmental stuff that they're supposed to be in compliance with. What do you do then?
Well, that's where my litigation background comes in. I have actual cases that I can tell them about with actual numbers. And again, you know, people respond very well to objective criteria, right? If I tell them, for example, yeah, that violation that you have, if you don't clean it up, yeah, I realize it's going to cost you $6,000 to clean it up. It's going to cost you $60,000 to $600,000 to not clean it up. Cost benefit analysis says clean it up.
Yeah.
That one's usually a little simpler. If I can give them some objective data, you know, and it's the same thing that I do with the worker misclassification penalties, because I get it. Like, look, you're starting out, hiring somebody is a very scary thing. It's a huge investment. So a lot of people will go to the independent contractors who aren't true independent contractors, And then they get that $500,000 penalty from the New York State Workers' Compensation Board. Yeah, that usually gets their attention.
Yeah.
And I have literally had $500,000 for a small design firm that was being run out of someone's apartment. He hadn't even made that probably in 10 years of working, right? That was his right. Gross revenue wasn't right. Anywhere near that. Right. So when you start looking at that and you just go back to the numbers, I've jokingly been called Nancy Numbers because I can almost always find some way of measuring what needs to be done, right? Because you know this too, as an accountant, if you're not measuring things and it's all just kind of esoteric and in that gray area, it's much easier to take no action. But if it's on your calendar at a specific time, or if it's in your data with a specific dollar amount or time allotment, it's a lot more likely that something's going to be done about it.
Have you ever been able to reduce an OSHA fine?
I don't normally deal with OSHA.
Right.
But I would definitely be able to find people who have. That's the other thing that I do, being solo myself and working with independent contractors, right? I know how to line those up very carefully. And I do have experts around me who work in various fields that could do that. Usually my clients if they have an OSHA concern, they're being more proactive because they've been working with me long enough to know I'm going to come at them. And again, it's because I know that if that OSHA violation is occurring, their employees know it's occurring too. And employees who don't feel safe on the job don't do a good job, right? If you're literally fearing for your own safety when you go to work and you don't feel like your employer cares about your safety, you don't give 100%.
No,
that's just human nature.
But the other part of that is, then why are you staying there? Why aren't you out looking for something else?
Who says they're not?
Well, we don't
know. See it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing is a lot of times they are looking elsewhere. And that's a trade-off. You know, this is another thing I talk to employers and employees about, is that every employment situation is a partnership. Whether you treat it that way or not, it's a partnership toward a common goal, right? And so in the situation you just described, you could easily look at that. Why would they stay even if they feel unsafe? There's something more important than their own safety. And a lot of times what it is it's their family. They need X amount of dollars to support their family. Maybe they got a kid going to college, or maybe they just have a certain lifestyle that they live more risky than others. This is the other reason I sometimes will get into the personalities, because we all value different things.
Right. Okay. I guess, you know, I mean, to me, I just don't bat. If you don't feel safe someplace, you know, there are other places to work. But that's my own, that's my own head.
And I do work with some, you know, some very high risk companies, right? Like high risk industries. And so I can tell you that there is a pay differential in those kinds of industries also, where you could be straight out of high school and get one of these jobs,
right,
for example, and they pay quite well.
Right.
And because you have in your mind, this is again why I work with mindset just as much as anything, is you can have in your mind that because you don't have an advanced degree that you aren't very marketable. And then you stay thinking that you're not very marketable, but you haven't necessarily looked for other work either. So I sometimes end up coaching people for that reason, because I see that you're locking yourself in to this limited view of your life and limited opportunities. And so then I'll say, you know, if you want to do the personality profile, we'll set up an action plan and start moving you in a direction to make sure you're choosing the life you have instead of just accepting what you think is available. So that's how I ended up getting into this, you know, this very holistic approach to things, is because I just hear what people need And I try to match them with something that will move them in a new direction.
Yeah. Getting back to workman's compensation.
Yeah.
You know, there are people who hire nannies for their children.
Uh-huh.
Or caregivers for their adult, for their elderly parents.
Yeah.
And they don't think they got to pay payroll taxes or, you know, have the workman's compensation and the disability. And frankly, when my father-in-law was in that position and we had to, you know, get the caregivers, I'm looking at the homeowner's policy and I'm seeing it covers workman's compensation, you know, workers' compensation, until I found out later, after submitting all that, you know, doing the rest of it correctly, paying the FICA and the Medicare, and paying the unemployment insurance.
Yep.
I was not doing it right because we got a letter from workman's comp. Where's the insurance?
Yeah. And that's a very, very common issue with domestic employers, right? And I can give you the classic example that I give all my clients who are domestic employers. It's understandable because it usually happens something like it happened for one of my clients. She was 98, I think, when she came to me. And, you know, she was living on her own. Her daughter was probably 70 something, right? Also living on her own somewhere else. They, you know, it wasn't a situation where she needed care. But then she started falling frequently in her apartment. And the building finally said, you know, in conjunction with the medical providers, the social worker and everyone at the hospital said, you know, you're going to have somebody that stays with you 24/7, not because she needed bathing or anything else, but what we called an elderly companion, just in case she fell, that she wouldn't be lying on the floor for 8 hours before someone found her. And she did what most people did, you know, and still do, is she's there at the hospital and said, okay, I better start calling people and figure out how to do this. And some friends said, oh, yeah, here, call this person, right? And they just hired and did what they thought they were supposed to. And then she ended up with an uninsured workers' compensation claim because she hired several people, right, to rotate for, that's a lot of hours, 24/7, right?
Right.
So she had, but they were all full-time. So what you're talking about is the insurance policy. Homeowners and renters might have some sort of provision for casual workers, but right, not for someone that's full time.
I learned the hard way. Yeah.
And then what, you know, luckily for you, you didn't end up with an uninsured workers' comp claim also.
Right.
Because then you're paying the penalty for not having the insurance, right, as well as the claim. And if it's somebody that, you know, throws out their back and needs back surgery, right, you're looking at several $100,000, yeah, out of your own pocket.
Right. And I was also lucky that we were able to knock the fine down to like $500.
Yeah.
Because they bought the story. Yeah. I just assumed that it was covered under the home, you know, the homeowners, and we'd be all right. But no.
Yeah, and you know, and that is one of the things, is the Workers' Compensation Board here is not looking to put people out on the street, right? They're not looking to close small businesses, unless you're one of those small businesses that's had multiple penalties, right, because you're not paying,
right?
Just like the tax department.
Yeah.
The main thing is to get you in compliance, right? They want employers in compliance because they don't want uninsured claims, right? And we've unfortunately learned the hard way over the years. And I've been doing this since 2002, so I've seen, you know, the transition over the years. And one of the nice things about it is we have a lot fewer uninsured claims because of the enforcement, because they'd linked up the tax Department of Labor and Workers' Compensation Board computer systems to make sure everything was lining up properly. Right. And if not, then they reach out to the employer and say, hey, we noticed that you don't have insurance. We need you to get insurance. And it's when people resist it, same thing with, or they just don't deal with it, right? Yeah. That it starts to accumulate into this huge problem. And so, you know, being able to confront conflict, right, is a really valuable skill. Another reason I got into teaching that is, like, I want people to realize you're always going to have problems. And if you're an entrepreneur, you're going to have a lot of them. It's risky to be on your own in a business, no matter what. Right. So just accept that.
Right. Right.
And learn to deal with the things that come up with skill instead of avoiding them and, you know, passing them on to other people. It's like, no, this is all going to come back to you. So at least know enough to be able to see that it's being done correctly.
In that area, does a single owner of a corporation, as a sole practitioner, you don't need to carry, if you're the only employee, you don't need to carry the workman's comp and the disability. As a single owner of a corporation, do they need, in New York, do they need to carry workman's comp and disability?
Not if they are the only employee. They're not required. I've heard that California requires them to cover themselves, but not in New York. There is an election that to not cover yourself, but you do need to make sure that you notify the workers' compensation board that that employee that you're claiming of the business, right? Because they're going to see payroll taxes and they're going to see different things.
Right.
They're going to see different filings. And unless you've notified the workers' compensation board that that employee is you, the single owner of that corporation, single shareholder, or the single member of the LLC, then they're just going to automatically, the computer's just going to automatically see employee getting a paycheck,
right,
payroll taxes being filed, payroll tax returns being filed. The computers are just automatically going to spit that notice out.
Okay.
Now, those are usually pretty easy penalties to resolve. And so, you know, just, I think the IRS does something similar, as you get the notice of the penalty first.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you absolutely owe it. It's just, look, quite frankly, we all know that that goes in the, oh, I should deal with that someday pile. But if it says penalty, you go, uh-oh, I better deal with that today.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Especially if it says $500,000.
Yeah. I mean, I say you get these letters from the workman's comp. Well, I mean, I've seen them. $1 million for a while. I don't even make that much money in 10 years.
And most of them, they are getting better at also at catching it earlier. So the ones I've been seeing this year are closer to $16,000, $17,000, you know, somewhere in that range, because they're getting on it right away. And some of the ways that it's coming up is the unemployment insurance benefits for the pandemic that are covering independent contractors.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot more data for them to work from,
which
means a lot more notices are going out. And it just makes sense. We've got millions of claims being filed, lots of money coming out. So the government is required to do its due diligence to make sure that it's collected from all the places that it's supposed to. So, you know, I get it. When you get that notice, it's very scary. But if you just think through the whole process, the government's not necessarily evil. It can feel that way sometimes, right? But they're literally doing their due diligence. As a taxpayer, you'd be very mad if they weren't and were just paying out without looking, just to make sure that they've collected from everybody, right?
Well, the fact that the government is, that's a different conversation.
It is. It's a different conversation. And I'm not saying it's never evil.
We'll have that the next time.
Look, it's run by humans, so it's always going to have problems.
Oh, God. One final question. What's your favorite book?
Oh, I have to say I'm really enjoying one that I'm rereading called The Art of Thinking Clearly by Rolf de Belli. And it's, again, it's a lot about the cognitive fallacies and cognitive errors that humans make. And so I'm really into this right now, thinking about probability and you know, being aware of things like groupthink and how we will sometimes adopt something as true because it kind of looks true, but if you actually run statistics and data, you realize that maybe your brain is playing a trick on you. And I like knowing that because I want to get ahead of my crazy brain.
Nancy, thank you so much. We appreciate you. I appreciate you taking the time to let me question you. And to my listeners, thank you for listening. And we will see you next time on the Tax Resolution Ninja Show. Take care. Have a good day.
Thanks so much, Alan.
Thanks for listening to the Tax Resolution Ninja Show. Be sure to click subscribe to get updates on our latest episodes.